So we are ready for you to start. Everyone, Tracy is a partner at Mehring Gear in Bismarck, and she's going to be talking to us about protecting client confidences in a digital world. So whenever you're ready, Tracy.
All right. Thank you, Tammy. And I appreciate that I am able to appear from my office in Bismarck rather than making a long trip to Grand Forks for the presentation. So yes, I am happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Tammy. And I'm going to cover a little bit of subjects beyond what Professor McGinnis was just addressing with you. And so we're going to talk about, you know, some of the issues pertaining to how we actually apply the ethical rules and new changes that were made 3 years ago that Professor McGinnis has talked to you about already, and how it, you know, kind of is a practical reality for us as lawyers and then, of course, as law firms. And so we'll just go ahead and get started. And at any time, if anybody has any questions, feel free to interrupt me. I can't see real, real well from where I'm at. I'm sitting in front of my computer monitor screen, but I'll do the best that I can. So I thought it'd be interesting to just kind of step back a little bit and talk about maybe where we started from, or more importantly, you know, where I started from. I'm entering my 25th year now of practicing law. Certainly there are a lot of lawyers that came before me, and there'll be a lot that come after me. But in terms of some perspective and our digital world, at least at the time when I started practicing law, these two things that are showing on the PowerPoint right now, Google and Apple iPhones, they didn't exist. And that's, as I said, less than 25 years ago. It's just, to me, kind of staggering to think about how our world has evolved even in this short period of time. Apple iPhone didn't come into being until 2007. So it's, you know, a recent phenomenon, but it has really transformed our world, including its impact on how lawyers practice law. So since, as I said, the perspective for me is my 25 years now almost of practicing law and where we began, which was for me, we had emails and computerized legal research, Westlaw and Lexis, that type of thing. That was pretty much the extent of our technology at that time. And since then, everything is becoming connected. In fact, we've got a, you know, coined a phrase. It's called the Internet of Things. And the world we're creating with all of these interconnected devices that we have. These numbers, I don't know if they're accurate or not. They're numbers that I came across in putting together these materials for all of you. You know, we currently have at least 10 billion interconnected devices. The estimates are that there will be 30 billion by 2020, so a year from now. I suspect those numbers are going to be even larger than that. Something else that I thought was really interesting and maybe even puts it in a little more perspective in terms of the data and the world that we have with respect to our digital world and the just sheer volume of data. I found this quote from Bruce Schneier, who is a expert in security and does a lot of presentations, papers, and counseling and consulting and so forth on information security and all of these types of things. And so one of the quotes that I came across from him is displayed here now on this PowerPoint slide. By 2020, so just less than, you know, 10 years ago, we were creating more data than we did from the beginning of time until 2003. By 2015, which is 4 years ago, 76 exabytes of data will travel across the internet every year. An exabyte is a billion bytes. And to put that in human terms, as Bruce Schneier has expressed, an exabyte of data is 500 billion pages of text. That is just a staggering number, and it's almost too hard and too massive to get your arms around. But the point is simply the volume and speed at which we're, you know, communicating with data in our digital world is just explosive. So we live in an era of unprecedented computing power, technology, information exchange, and connectivity. In our lifetime, we will and have seen autonomous vehicles. That will transform our driving world, assuming those are actually one day on the roads and kind of becoming a regular part of our daily life. Its impact on lawyers, too, is not without any consequences. I have this other illustration here on this slide about AIG, Legal Operations Company. AIG is a very large insurance carrier, and it's known to me because it's primarily the type of work that I do in my practice, which is insurance defense work, in particular Med-Mal defense work. Our clients and big insurance carriers like AIG also collect data, and they collect data about us as lawyers in terms of how we manage cases, the time in which we get those cases done, and those types of things. So data is being collected for all sorts of purposes, including how lawyers provide services to their clients and those kinds of things. And they matter because if you anticipate wanting to maintain clients, you're going to have to meet their expectations and other types of service matters. So what does it mean for lawyers? Well, we're connected to the internet just like everybody else, and therefore we are exposed to the risks and threats to information security. We're not immune from those risks and threats. And so what are some of the risks that are presented to lawyers and law firms? Well, quite obviously we have large amounts of valuable information that includes confidential client data. And law firms, I think, and I think it's probably borne out as well, are perceived to be easy targets. Lawyers and law firms have been, I think, kind of slow to respond to the information security risks and threats, and maybe not stay ahead of the game in terms of, you know, addressing them, preparing for them, responding to them, and those types of things, notwithstanding the most sacrosanct part of what we do is protect our clients and the communications we have with our clients, i.e. the attorney-client privilege. In fact, in 2011, the FBI warned that hackers see attorneys as a backdoor to the valuable data that we have for our clients. And when you have failed security, the consequence is going to be data breach. What I'm showing you here on this particular slide is just kind of an interesting picture. It comes from a website, Information is Beautiful. And what this particular website does is display in a kind of a bubble format all of the really large, massive data breaches that we've had over the last years that have involved, you know, the disclosure improperly of information, whether it be customer information, those types of things. And the cost of data breaches is quite large. You know, according to some statistics, it can be as much as $217 per lost or stolen record. So, as I said, law firms are not immune from security risks, information security risks, and the threats. And what I've, you know, presented here is a number of different examples that have been reported about law firms. One of them, it does not involve a law firm. It involved a really large phishing email scam with very significant consequences for a healthcare provider. But the point here is that law firms aren't immune. There was one of the largest data breaches, quite frankly, involving a law firm. I think it was the one in Panama, D.L. Piper, as I recall, that involved a really massive breach of client information. These are some other incidents. Some are you know, not very significant, but they nonetheless illustrate that lawyers and law firms need to take appropriate precautions in order to protect against these types of security incidences and, you know, involve disclosures of client information. So what are the different causes and types of security threats? And, you know, they are illustrated in the examples that was just displayed. But the causes of security threats include things that are, you know, malicious, criminal. For example, whether it be from the inside or outside, where you have maybe an employee who's disgruntled, who maybe has been asked to terminate from the employment under adverse circumstances and decides to do something malicious to the information security system of the law firm. Outsider threats such as hackers, those types of things. Of course, human error. Human error accounts for a large percentage of data breaches just across the board, not just within the setting of the legal system. System and IT glitches, you know, in other words, where, you know, the software isn't current or you don't have firewalls in place, those types of things. And then the different types of data breaches that can occur involve all sorts of types, including lost and stolen devices, whether it be a laptop, cell phone. Theft of laptops is probably the number one type of data breach, not only just for any type of injury, industry, but in particular for the healthcare industry. I'm really familiar with the healthcare industry. As I said, it's what I primarily do in my practice is med-mal defense of healthcare providers. And part of that work involves, you know, having some intimate familiarity with the different laws and so forth that govern healthcare providers, such as HIPAA and that type of thing. And when a healthcare provider finds itself in trouble with the federal government, when, for example, PHI has been improperly disclosed or used, the most common type of improper use or disclosure is a lost or stolen laptop. Other types include social engineering and phishing. This is when, you know, someone who's trying to get your attention and is disguising themselves as someone who knows you and trying to entice you to click on a link in an email, that type of thing. And innocently, you do that, and next thing you know, your information security system is on a lockdown because it included some kind of a ransomware software. Improper disposal is another type of information security threat. Impermissible access and disclosure, where, for example, let's say you have a rather large firm and you have not segregated your access to your information security system to, you know, people who have a need to know about a particular matter. You know, those types of things can get you in trouble because you may have people wanting to just kind of curiosity or snooping, that type of thing, look at information for which they have no reason to be looking. Ransomware, I mentioned that. Vendor insecurity. Vendor insecurity involves the people with whom you do business, whether it be, you know, an IT company who you've hired to manage your information security system. Let's say you're a small firm and you don't want to take that task on your own. That IT entity would be considered a vendor, and so you need to be attentive to the precautions and security measures that you have in place to make sure that the vendor is has appropriate access or not to the information and has got his own safeguards in place so that there isn't a threat to that vendor taking that information improperly. The Target breach that happened, gosh, it's probably about 3 years ago now. That was a breach, not directly by Target, but it involved one of Target's vendors. And then another example, and the final one that I have here displayed is hacking, where you have, you know, basically a criminal trying to, you know, get into systems and take information and hold it hostage for a ransom or sell it on the black market or whatever the case might be. So in light of these threats and risks, quite a few years ago, the American Bar Association commissioned a study specifically to address the impact of technology on the legal profession. The commission was called the Commission on Ethics 2020. Their work was very comprehensive and has covered many years. Our Chief Justice of our Supreme Court, Justice Vandewalle, was a member of this commission. What came out of this study was that the ABA determined that the regulation of lawyers should be updated in light of how technology has transformed the practice of law. And what came out of that then was amendments to the model rules of professional responsibility, most of which North Dakota follows and has adopted. We don't adopt each and every rule or change that's proposed by the ABA under the model rules, but by and large, we follow the model rules. And those amendments, as I said, that came out of that Commission on Ethics 2020, have come to be known as the technology amendments. And what I have here is a little table that kind of displays, maybe nicely, maybe you can see it very, see it well where you're at, but kind of has a little checkbox in terms of the rules, the specific rules of professional responsibility that were impacted by these amendments to the rules. And I'm not going to go over all those rules. Professor McGinnis just did that. But basically, it falls into two categories in terms of the kind of the purpose and the goal of these rule amendments. One is, you know, to protect and maintain client confidences. Rule 1.1 and Rule 1.6 are directed at that, or the changes, I should say, that were made to those rules. And then the second category is to ensure that others protect and maintain client confidences. And again, Rule 1.1 was impacted. And then Rule 5.3, which addresses the responsibilities that lawyers have regarding non-lawyer assistance. And so what are the kind of the more immediate takeaways from the technology amendments? And I apologize if I'm covering territory that Professor McGinnis has already covered. But at a very, you know, basic fundamental level, the point of the amendments was to, you know, encourage and mandate in some instances that lawyers increase the level of their technology and security awareness, and that we need to understand these new obligations as duties to secure client confidences. We have a duty to store, transmit, and outsource client communications and confidences securely. And we need to understand what the sources of that duty are. In other words, the ethical rules, certainly, but there may be other sources as well. There may be legal obligations at the federal or state level. There may be contractual obligations, or even your own clients may impose obligations on you independent of any other source to protect their information properly. An example of a law imposing a duty on lawyers is, again, HIPAA. If you do work for healthcare providers who are subject to HIPAA, that law firm and lawyer become subject to HIPAA as well, which imposes, you know, quite onerous burdens to comply with HIPAA. And that's now the law since 2009 when HIPAA was amended, and it was amended by HITECH. So there can be all sorts of sources just beyond the professional responsibility to protect and secure client information. Rules 1 and 1.1 and 1.6, what they're directed at is, you know, instructing lawyers that they need to take competent and reasonable measures to safeguard client information. And these obligations apply to the use of all technology, whether it be your computers that you're sitting at in your office, mobile devices, you know, your cell phones or your laptops, network servers, cloud computing, and outsourcing. Regarding Rule 1.1 and 5.3, which is ensuring others appropriately protect and secure client confidences, you need to make sure before you entrust a third party with client confidences that you know and understand the measures that will be used to protect and secure that information. And sometimes that can require that you enter into a written confidentiality agreement with that third party or outsourced party. So how do lawyers, you know, respond or react, I guess, to these ethical obligations under the technology amendments? Well, according to the ABA, and this is a direct quote from the American Bar Association, in part as a consequence of the Commission on 2020 Ethics, but also the American Bar Association Cybersecurity Legal Task Force. The ABA strongly encourages lawyers and law firms to put together, to develop, implement, and maintain an appropriate cybersecurity program that complies with applicable ethical and legal obligations, which then too should be tailored to the scope and nature of the organization and the data and systems to be protected. So what's an information security program? Well, at its very fundamental level, it's a program, whether it's going to be a real formalized program or something a little less formal, but the key elements of it, including that it must address people, which often is the weakest link in any information security program, written policies, and then of course technology, which is your, you know, overall information security system. And so some of the principles of an information security program include, first, that you kind of sit back and see the big picture. And I say sit back because depending on, you know, what type of setting you are in as a lawyer, whether you are, you know, a solo practitioner, you know, in other words, you're all by yourself with maybe some, you know, minimal support from a legal assistant, or you're in a medium-sized firm, or you're in a large law firm, and that's the private setting, or even in a governmental setting, which, you know, by and large in that setting, you know, the program will have already been developed and implemented by the government. But regardless, you just kind of need to take a look at where you're at and what it is that you're wanting to accomplish to make sure that you have, you know, a handle on what your information security system is, what types of information you have, and how it's used and how you need to protect it, particularly electronically. I also say to know the law and your regulator. And the reason I say that is because of, as I mentioned, the sources of the duty to protect client confidences can come from places that aren't just limited to the professional rules of responsibility. If you have some other legal obligation, for example, HIPAA, or even in the financial services sector, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, you will want to make sure that your program complies with the legal requirements imposed under those particular laws. Somebody should be designated as the point person, if you will, with responsibility for information security. Risk assessment should be conducted. And again, that's going to be driven by the nature and size of the organization and the way that information is maintained, stored, used, transmitted, those types of things. And then you want to, you know, put that down on paper and develop a written information security program and then follow it. And what that consists of largely is policies, policies that address, you know, how the people within the organization are allowed to use and disclose and store information as it pertains to client confidences. Manage your vendors. You need to know who your vendors are and understand what their role is with your organization, and then make sure that however information is being shared with them, that appropriate measures are put in place. The workforce needs to be educated and trained as well. And that would, of course, start with the policies that you've put in place for your information security program. But at a very fundamental level, again, it's the people who need to understand, you know, what the program is and that they have an awareness of the policies and are following them and so forth. That's, as I said, usually the weakest link in the overall system is the people, the human error. And then consider cybersecurity insurance. That's, you know, something maybe more unique to the private setting. And then lastly, if you need help, get help. The ABA Cybersecurity Legal Task Force, as I mentioned, that's another group, and it's specifically devoted to addressing the impact of technology on the legal profession. And there's all sorts of tools and resources that this group puts out that's available to members of the American Bar Association. And one of the things that the ABA Cybersecurity Legal Task Force has urged and stressed is that this responsibility to understand what it is that lawyers are doing with client confidences and communications in our digital world is a very fundamental obligation of each individual lawyer, certainly the law firms, but the lawyers as well. And so this particular task force has urged that all lawyers need to understand and address the risks to make sure that they are complying not only with the ethical obligations, but any legal obligations as well. So what can we as individual lawyers do ourselves to make sure that we are complying with our professional responsibilities and the law? Well, first, we should make sure we have the education and training not to become a technology expert, but at least for a kind of a basic fundamental level of technology competence. And then it's our obligation to continue to stay updated on the technology and current with the technology because it changes very rapidly. And then just as to some reasonable security measures as it pertains to us individually in our own devices, for example, our cell phones. When I started practicing law, I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't get one until quite a few years later, but now it's attached to my hip. And I maintain a lot of stuff on there that can pertain to client confidences. And so you need to make sure that there are appropriate protections in place for mobile device tools, such as cell phones, laptops, mobile devices as well, laptop locks, remote wipe and encryption software, password protection. These are all things that I'm sure all of you have heard many, many times, so I'm not telling you anything new. But password protection and make sure that they're strong passwords. Don't use social media when it involves client communications. That's not permitted and that would be inappropriate. Don't use public Wi-Fi or even a hotel Wi-Fi. Make sure that you're using some type of secured internet connection, whether it be a VPN or otherwise. Don't use unsanctioned or unsecured cloud storage that involves client data and communications. Dropbox, for example, is a cloud storage, and it kind of gives me nightmares about it, actually, when I think about lawyers using it and what information they're putting in it and sharing it and so forth, because it's not secured. And then, you know, make sure we use proper disposal practices. So if you, for example, were to buy a new cell phone because there's a more updated version of it, you know, don't just, you know, haphazardly discard your old cell phone. And then finally, if you need help, again, make sure you get the appropriate expertise, specific technology expertise, if you feel like you're way beyond your level of awareness and need some extra help. Here on this slide, what I've just shown you here is just a couple examples of some really, really good legal resources for lawyers. There's lots of resources out there for all the other industries, but this is specific to lawyers. I mentioned the ABA Cybersecurity Legal Task Force. They have a handbook. It's in volume 2, I believe. It's the second edition of this handbook. So if you're interested in learning and reading and studying a little bit more about it, that's a really excellent resource. The Sedona Conference, too, they've got a paper out that is specific to information security practices, recommendations, and so forth for lawyers and law firms. So that's pretty unique, and it's a very helpful paper if you're interested, again, in looking at this a little more detail, because we've spent just 30 minutes here talking about it, and as you can tell, it's a big subject, and it's a lot of territory to cover in a small period of time. And so with that, that's the end of my presentation. I don't think I have time for any questions, but I'll follow the lead of Tammy at your end.
All right. Well, I think we're good. Thank you so much for doing this.